From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The largest mass protest in modern Peruvian history as Alberto Fujimori is inaugurated for an unprecedented third term as president. 81 people are arrested in Minneapolis protesting genetic engineering of animals. Some are calling it a mini Seattle. And a look at the case of two fired Fox journalists suing their network for killing their story on Monsanto. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In New York, a grand jury has declined to indict an undercover narcotics officer in the shooting death of unarmed Haitian immigrant Patrick Dorisman. Dorisman's parents and sister told reporters they want the U.S. Justice Department to take over the case. Dorisman was killed on March 16th after an undercover officer asked where he could buy marijuana. The family has filed a $100 million civil claim against the city. The case assumed added significance when Mayor Giuliani, then still running for the U.S. Senate, set off a furor by releasing Dorisman's sealed juvenile record. The mayor also publicized a toxicology report. The U.S. military is sending millions of dollars in arms to Philadelphia for display during the Republican National Convention. But Defense Secretary William Cohen denied yesterday the Pentagon is playing partisan politics in violation of its own strict rule. Cohen said the show at the Philadelphia Navy Yard during next week's convention was sought jointly by Republican and Democratic congressmen and that a similar display could be sent to next month's Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles. His comments came shortly after Pentagon spokesperson Ken Bacon told reporters that the military services would be providing the, quote, educational display of weaponry from helicopters to a spy drone aircraft and a tank. The Defense Department has a strict rule against even the perception of becoming involved in partisan politics. Defense Secretary William Cohen is the former Republican senator from Maine. Meanwhile, the Senate yesterday joined the House in approving a military spending bill of $287 billion for next year. That amount is $5 billion more than requested by the Pentagon or the White House. The measure is an increase of more than $21 billion in military spending. That amount is greater than the entire foreign aid budget. Napster devotees took to their keyboards yesterday to rally support for the embattled song-swapping software company and download free music for the last time before a court decision that effectively shuts down its service goes into effect today. Napster is preparing to appeal. Napster's message boards were saturated with calls to boycott the Recording Industry Association of America. That's the trade group representing the world's five largest record labels. It's accusing Napster of facilitating widespread copyright infringement of its music. On Wednesday night, a U.S. District Court in San Francisco ruled in favor of a preliminary injunction to force the site to stop offering access to digital versions of songs whose copyrights are owned by the major labels. A federal judge in San Francisco ruled yesterday that the Hearst Corporation's $660 million purchase of the San Francisco Chronicle did not violate antitrust laws and that the company would have had legal justification for closing the San Francisco Examiner had it chosen to. The Chronicle has been a fierce journalistic rival of the Examiner, the newspaper that gave William Randolph Hearst his start in publishing for more than a century. The two newspapers have also been business partners for the past 35 years. As he made the rounds of the television talk shows yesterday, Dick Cheney confidently defended his votes in the 1980s against gun control, abortion rights, and education spending, but he slipped when he tried to justify his opposition to an obscure resolution in 1986 that called on South Africa to release Nelson Mandela from prison. Democrats immediately pounced on the issue and vowed to use it against the Republican ticket in the fall campaign. On NBC's Today Show, Cheney, the expected Republican vice presidential nominee, said his vote was based on a disagreement over whether economic sanctions were the best way to end apartheid. Cheney said, "The debate that we had at the time had to do with how we could best pursue our policies in South Africa." He went on to say, "Nobody supported apartheid. We were all against it, but there was a big debate over the best leverage we could use to get Nelson Mandela free." Fiji's president today swore in a new cabinet amid tight security, moving to restore calm in the Pacific nation that has been in turmoil since a May coup. Although the new government was strongly pro-indigenous Fijian, it includes no close supporters of coup leader George Speight, whose siege, waged in the name of ethnic Fijian rights, unleashed a wave of civil unrest.
Justice is done.
Foreign policy.
I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Crime and punishment.
Today, the Board of Pardons and Paroles voted to allow Mr. Graham's execution. Justice is done.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Join me and Juan Gonzalez for 2 weeks of convention coverage. From July 31st to August 4th, we'll be live from Philadelphia. And August 14th to August 18th, live from Los Angeles. We'll be covering the convention, the shadow conventions. We'll be in the corporate suites and live from the protests in the streets. It's a multimedia extravaganza. We'll be broadcasting on community radio, on public access television, on Dish Network, and the Internet. Tune in.
Soon the world will be ours.
And our convention coverage is called Breaking with Convention, Power, Protest, and the Presidency. We hope you all tune in throughout the week next week. I'm Amy Goodman here with co-host Juan Gonzalez, and we'll be together in Philadelphia for the week.
Yes, and to our listeners around the country, you should try to check the webpage of Democracy Now! Over the weekend to find out exactly which stations and which public access channels will be carrying our broadcast 2 hours every morning from 8 to 10 all of next week, and then in Los Angeles from the Democratic Convention.
And that, of course, is the time that it is broadcasting, although stations take the show at whatever time they choose to take it. All sorts of things happening in Philadelphia, Juan. Pretty interesting to hear about this military display of weaponry from the Pentagon.
Yes, the old Philadelphia Navy Yard is coming in handy, and even though apparently the Pentagon has been urged not to make a political show, I don't see how they could not be making a political show at a Republican convention. But yes, they're going to be displaying their hardware for all of the delegates to see, including some hardware that is still being debated.
People are more used to seeing these kinds of pictures looking at other countries than looking at the United States. And in fact, we're going to go down to another country right now, very important to the U.S. administration and foreign policy, and that is Peru. Today, Alberto Fujimori is going to be re-inaugurated for his third term as Peru's president. Only two foreign presidents will be attending the official swearing-in ceremony at Congress. 14 Latin American leaders have already turned down their invitations to attend, and outside the streets of Lima have been bursting with massive demonstrations from all sectors of Peruvian society in what's been called the largest mass protests in the history of Fujimori's 10-year authoritarian regime. The opposition candidate, Alejandro Toledo, pulled out of the race, charging Fujimori with widespread fraud and voter intimidation. Fujimori had also changed the constitution so that he could be reelected to a third term, something which was previously prohibited in Peru.
The demonstrations, which have been filling the streets of Lima this past week, are calling for Fujimori to step aside. On Wednesday, thousands of women marched demanding a democratic voice, and yesterday the streets were bursting as people who had come to the capital from all parts of Peru mobilized against Fujimori's illegitimate presidency. Latest reports from Peru say the authorities manning the entry post to the city are removing bus license plates and preventing people from coming into Lima. Today's protest has been named the March of the Four Suyos, a reference to the far reaches of the ancient Inca Empire.
And in Lima, Peru right now is Jo Marie Burt. She is editor of the NACLA Report on the Americas, North American Congress on Latin America. We're also joined on the telephone by Pancho Soberón, who is director of the Pro-Human Rights Association of Peru. Jo Marie Burt, can you tell us what the streets look like right now?
Hi, Amy. Yeah, the streets in Lima are bursting with people, and there is an incredible mix of enthusiasm and indignation. People from all walks of life, from all over Peru, are in the streets demanding new elections and that Fujimori step down. You have peasants, workers, professors, professionals, women. There was even a delegation of retired policemen last night demanding that Fujimori step down. There's been little protests, repression on the streets yesterday and the day before. But as I heard you say in your introduction, there has been efforts to prevent large delegations coming from the interior of the country. So a lot of people have been prevented from actually getting to Lima. So that's how things are looking right now.
And until now, there have been no arrests of any protesters or attacks on the protests?
Well, I haven't heard of any. Pancho probably might be able to better tell you if there's been anything going on in recent hours, because people were staying out all night last night. There was an all-night vigil, and protests are starting today at 9 in the morning because Fujimori is scheduled to be inaugurated at 10 a.m.
Pancho Soberón of the Pro-Human Rights Association of Peru, how did these mass protests get organized? Were they all at the instigation of the opposition presidential candidate, Toledo?
Well, we're expecting that in the next few hours, there are concentrating people in the Paseo de la República or starting the march to the Congress and the Plaza Mayor. That was the announcement made last night by Alejandro Toledo when he also announced the constitution of a national front for struggling for democracy in Peru in the next period. We do not have received information at this point what other mobilizations have been produced yesterday in other cities. We expected that in Arequipa, in Iquitos, and in other places in the country, mobilizations have been made by citizens and social organizations and political parties. Yesterday, when the manifestation ended, we did not register denounces of police intervention. We hope that perhaps this morning there are going to be some tensions when the columns of the march approaches to the Plaza Mayor and the Congress.
And Pancho Soberón, is the intention of the demonstrators to stay in the streets until the government resigns, or is there an ending date or time for the demonstrations?
Well, the demonstrations will end today in this period, but as I said, yesterday was announced that a national front of all political parties, of civil society organizations, has been demanded by Alejandro Toledo. And from there on, also, he announced that a shadow cabinet will be conformed with personalities of the opposition to follow up how the demands for democracy, how the agenda proposed by the OAS is achieved by the dialogue and negotiations between the government and the opposition, with a claim of a final general new elections with international standards to bring democracy to Peru.
We're also joined on the telephone from Lima by Sofia Macher. She is the president of the National Human Rights Coordinating Committee of Peru. Can you tell us about the Women's March that is feeding into this largest mass mobilization that we've seen in many years in Peru?
Yes, this is a second women's demonstration in this short time, and the last one was really a largest woman demonstration, and because was a lot of women from outside Lima arrived and It was a very, very impressive demonstration because the woman was a very hard, no? And it was also very, how is it, pacifico?
Peaceful.
Yes. Yes. But I think the feeling is that they are very strong women with very clear speeches and confront the government very clear, no? And I think it was very important for all the population to see this kind of demonstration, give a very good feeling, no?
Pancho Soberón, what has been the reaction of the supporters of Fujimori, either in the military or in the other groups within Peruvian society who support him? Because he did get some votes, obviously, in his race for the presidency.
Well, there was an attempt by President Fujimori to produce confusion among citizens when he announced what he called a moderate opposition, was named as prime minister for his next executive. I think that this produced a reaction, particularly with peasants and citizens from Huancavelica, where this person, Mr. Salas, was the mayor of the city. He, in the past, has produced a march with peasants to Lima, and now he was accused of treason to the demands of decentralization of the citizens of Huancavelica and provinces. This was the attempt in these days to announce a destructive measure of the government with expecting the results of the March of the Four Suyos. We don't know what is going to be the message of Fujimori this morning when he assumed his new third inconstitutional period, and then we could comment what the proposals are.
Only two leaders came to this swearing-in that's happening today. Hugo Banzer of Bolivia, former military dictator, Gustavo Noboa of Ecuador, elected vice president, came to power in January after a military-backed coup ousted the president. 14 Latin American presidents turned down the invitations to attend. Joe Marie Bird, editor of NACLA, you're there in Lima. What about the U.S. support of Fujimori? They've always backed him, poured millions into the Peruvian military, knowing its human rights abuse history, and yet seem to be somewhat backing off. Is it because Alejandro Toledo also very much connected to the World Bank and they see that Fujimori's on his last legs?
Well, I think the larger issue here is that Fujimori has really passed the limit of what's acceptable internationally for in terms of democratic rule. And I think the U.S. is looking at other parts of the region and probably other parts of the world, saying to itself, if we don't do something here, if we don't take a stand here, there's going to be further problems. And that's not to say that the U.S. is any big champion of democracy, but there's a status quo here that it's interested in maintaining. The whole idea of free elections and free trade, free elections and the image of democracy, at least, if not anything in substance, is good for business. And I think that's something that's behind U.S. policy. But you also have to remember that Peru is one of the main fronts in the drug war. So even if the U.S. government backs off in giving military aid to Peru, it's not going to stop giving drug aid. I can't imagine that it's going to stop giving drug aid. So I think you're going to see mixed signals from Washington to Peru. I think that's that's what happened with the OAS also.
And finally, Pancho Soberón, your major objections to Fujimori, and do you see him being ousted by the end of the year?
Well, we hope that at least in this next period, civil society and opposition continue struggling for democracy, and that after producing basic reforms in democratic institutions, we could achieve a new election, a new popular consultation to bring Peru to a final democrat with participation of citizens of all over the country. This is the task, and for that task, also human rights movements, human rights organizations, we are with the commitment of supporting the activities of Peruvian citizenship.
We want to thank you all for being with us. Pancho Soberón, director of the Pro-Human Rights Association of Peru. Also, Joe Marie Bird, editor of NACLA, report on the Americas in Lima right now. And Sofia Macher, president of the National Human Rights Coordinating Committee of Peru, all speaking to us from Lima, where the largest mass protest in modern Peruvian history is taking place against the backdrop of Alberto Fujimori being inaugurated for an unprecedented third term. When we return, we're going to stay in Lima for a few more minutes and speak to Mark Berenson, father of Lori Berenson, who's at the airport about to go visit his daughter in prison in Arequipa, Peru's second city. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we remain in Lima, Peru for a few more minutes with Mark Berenson, father of Lori Berenson, who was sentenced to life in prison in Peru, a young woman from the United States who went down to Peru, a solidarity activist in Latin America, and at the end of 1995 was arrested by the Peruvian secret police. She was put on trial in well-known trials in Peru that happened to thousands of Peruvians as well, military tribunals, hooded judges. She did not hear the evidence that was presented against her, and she was ultimately convicted with treason against the fatherland. They said she was a leader of a terrorist organization put at the Yanamayo prison where many other political prisoners are held, which is high in the Andes. And then when there was international attention from the Organization of American States, she was brought down to a lower altitude prison and put in maximum security at the Socabaya prison, where I had the opportunity to see her last year. She can be seen by almost no one but her family and official delegations and religious people. Mark Berenson, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. I'm here in cloudy Lima in the airport. There's a lot of bunting. It's very festive here. But I don't, there isn't the military presence, at least over here. Things are quiet, but I am 20 to 30 minutes away from Pancho and Sophia and Joe Marie, where the action is. But I did read the papers this morning, and I have the photos to bring home to you. Liberacion, a paper run by Cesar Hildebrand, a very popular journalist from the opposition, and La Republica, shows the estimated crowds between 200,000 and 250,000 last night. But if you watch Peruvian television this morning at the airport, as I do, you don't get that sense at all. They show that there's practically nobody in the streets. You would get the sense that maybe 500,000 people. That's the way the Fujimori government has manipulated the media here when you watch the televisions that all the Peruvians watch.
Well, Mark Berenson, a similar situation here. The front page of the New York Times today has not Peru and the massive demonstrations, but a huge takeout piece attacking Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, and the radical reforms that he's instituting, but very almost nothing about Peru. I'd like to ask you, since the uproar over the recent elections, has there been any change on the part of the Fujimori government in terms of the way that your daughter is being treated or any prospects for any change in her situation?
Well, it's difficult to assess because during the Peruvian runoff campaign, Lori Berenson was the number one issue in the Peruvian political campaign. Both candidates were kicking her around like a soccer or football. Who can boot her further to show how macho they are against the fabricated terrorists that they made of Lori? And it was sad. She took a terrible beating, as did the United States, because of Senate Resolution 43 calling for the U.S. to withhold economic, military, and political aid from Peru unless Peru got its act together. Now, Peru hasn't gotten its act together, but that Senate resolution caused demagoguery against the U.S. and against Lori. The anger at the U.S., the Yankee imperialist interfering in our affairs and then taking it out on Lori publicly. So we don't know what that's going to do. The new prime minister, Federico Salas, who ran an opposition presidency and got about 2.5% of the vote, is very anti-Lori. He was the person who debated Toledo in Miami on a teleconference to Lima, where he accused Lima of being soft on terrorism, and he said he'd never free Lori, is guilty. This guy is a clown as far as I'm concerned. Mr. Salas was part of a party run by a person named Ray Ray, and now congressman. And last summer, it's interesting for you all to know that an emissary of Ray Ray approached Broder and I in New York, went to dinner with us, and asked us for like $10,000 for the Ray Ray campaign. We never heard of the guy. Now, I'm not saying that Salas, who badmouthed Lori, knew anything about that, but we certainly said we're not being involved in the politics of Peru. We had never even heard of Ray Ray, and it was just interesting to see that it was Salas who attacked Toledo about Lori, and that's what got it all started here.
What is the level of organizing you're doing in the United States here, Mark Berenson, when you're not visiting Lori Berenson in prison in Peru?
Well, I do know that the local chapter of the Committee for Lori Berenson, Roeder would be able to tell you more about that, is participating in front of the Peruvian embassy in Washington today in solidarity with what's going on. I mean, we're in the midst of a dictatorship that will officially start at the inauguration today, and that was said by Congresswoman Anil Townsend, who said the other day, this is state terrorism, and we are in the throes of a real dictatorship. That was a practical quote from Anil Townsend 2 days ago, the opposition congresswoman.
Given that the U.S. is changing its view of Fujimori, will that impact Lori's case?
Well, are they? I heard Joel Marie Burt say that, and I do take some opposition to what, yes, there have been mixed signals, but take a look at the New York Times earlier this week, this played first page in all the Peruvian papers. It made a statement on page 4 of Sunday's New York Times that, well, we got to live with Fujimori, we're going to work with him again, after all, he's a great partner in the drug war, and then it was insinuated without a quote that Mr. Toledo is too inexperienced and lacking an ability to really change democracy in Peru. What experience did Toledo lack 2 weeks ago or now that Fujimori didn't lack 10 years ago? Both were professors. Both had no governmental experience. Fujimori has shown that he's able to run a country in whatever way you want to say for 10 years. But for the New York Times to make that insinuation as if it came from the State Department, it may be mixed signals, but I think that there's a real acceptance of Mr. Fujimori. We're going to live with him. He's our man again. And it really is the ashes of Senator Paul Coverdell of Georgia are not even cold yet. And this is really, to me, a slap in Senator Coverdell's face, because while he never publicly supported Lori, Mr. Coverdell strongly stood up against the junk that's been going on here in the elections, against the lack of real democracy, and I give him credit. I think the Senate will miss him, and I wish he would have been more forceful for Lori, but he really did stand for democracy in Peru.
Mark
Berenson, his place now.
We have to end this segment of the program. If people want to find out more about Lori's case, where can they go? Where can they go on the web or call?
The website is www.freelori, F-R-E-E-L-O-R-I, .org.
That's freelori.org. Mark Berenson, Lori Berenson's father, speaking to us from the Lima airport, where he now heads off to Arequipa, to the Socabaya prison, to visit his daughter for the weekend. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue on the issue of protests, but here in the United States, This past week in Minneapolis, the International Society for Animal Genetics held their annual international conference. Scientists have been mapping the genome of common livestock, they say, to determine new and cutting-edge methods of disease resistance and to improve the animals for market and laboratory uses. That improve, I put in quotes. Activists who converged on Minneapolis to protest the genetic engineering of animals were met with Seattle-type police treatment, and close to 100 were arrested. We're joined on the phone right now by Olivia Kramer, a member of the local Minneapolis group Grain Rage, Resistance Against Genetic Engineering, RAGE. Welcome to Democracy Now, Olivia.
Hi there.
Tell us what happened this week.
Excuse me?
Tell us what happened this week.
Well, essentially, we mobilized a couple hundred people. Over the weekend, we had a counter conference where we did workshops and discussions and videos and such. And since it's such a new issue, it's not something that people fully grasp. We spent a lot of time going over the science and the politics and economics behind the issue. And then on Sunday night, we met in a local park, and we had a speak out and teach-in that went really well. There was several hundred people there, all really attentive, obviously really interested in learning about the issue. And we had about 15 speakers up there. And then we went on a downtown march at night, and mostly on the sidewalk. And the police wouldn't let us be in the street at all, even though we tried. So we, you know, pretty much kept to the sidewalks, and we ended up back at the park. And no, there were no incidents. It was really good. There was the conference was going on inside the Hyatt Regency, and we encircled the Hyatt several times, although they had really barricaded the conference. And actually, the scientists, I don't think they ever really left the hotel except for one event in St. Paul. So it was really a military state all around the conference. And then on Saturday, people met again in the morning downtown, and we had another march. And this time, we pretty much did the same thing, except for this time, the police wouldn't even let us march on the sidewalk. And people were essentially boxed in for quite a while, where on both sides, the police were completely covering the sidewalk, and we couldn't move. And so eventually, people just used their spontaneity and element of surprise, and we ended up being able to get through the police lines. And we marched around in the street and on the sidewalk for a couple hours, and eventually we came to a point where the police actually tried to trap us from leaving the downtown area, even though they had corralled us out of the downtown area. And so people got together and got out of the police barricade, basically by pushing through the police lines. And that's pretty much where the first clash started, and they used a lot of pepper spray. They actually ended up denying using it later, and it's still kind of an issue of contention because there's so much media that was right there when the pepper spray was being used, and the police ended up actually trying to convince the public that some protesters had let loose tear gas in the crowd, and that's just ridiculous. I mean, it's really hard to get tear gas, so. And there's quite a few witnesses that saw them lobbing tear gas canisters. I mean, they were completely tooled up. They had exactly Seattle-style combat gear and rubber bullet guns, beanbag guns. They were on horses. It was definitely an over-mobilization, although it's really not surprising considering that they're so intent on intimidating the sort of current form, the current surge of protests, from continuing, and they'll do anything that they can. And in fact, they have used a lot of methods even since then, other than in the street. They've raided a local activist house.
Olivia, I'd like to interrupt you for a second. We're also joined on the phone by Peter Wood, who's in the research and investigation unit of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. So welcome to Democracy Now, Peter.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to ask you, the scientists, you were not there in Minneapolis, I understand, but the scientists who were gathering say they were interested basically in conducting research to prevent disease, to improve the quality of life for Americans. What are your objections to the kind of genetic engineering they're involved in, or the research in genetic engineering?
Genetic engineering isn't about improving nutrition or feeding the hungry. It's really about increasing profits for large-scale corporate farmers. If you look at some of the sponsors of this particular conference, you would see companies such as the Pig Improvement Company, hybrid turkeys, and others who make a living in turning sentient beings into nothing more than meat machines and who suffer greatly.
The Pig Improvement Company?
Yes, that's actually one of their sponsors, the Pig Improvement Company, hybrid turkeys, and others who, like I said, exploit animals and turn them into nothing more than meat machines who live miserable, tortured lives so they can scrape more meat off their bones. So we reject this idea that that they're actually improving health or nutrition or feeding the hungry. It's really about increasing their profits, and I think the sponsorship of this event proves that. And they're also playing with Russian roulette with the building blocks of life, and sooner or later we're bound to hit the loaded chamber. It's very dangerous, and that's what people should be focused on.
I was just thinking there could be all sorts of companies. You got the pig improvement company, PIC. Maybe HICA, which would be the human improvement company, up, you know, to just improve us all. Peter Wood, how powerful is this organization that held this major international meeting in Minneapolis?
Well, they seem to be extremely powerful. They have major corporate sponsorship. They have the support of the federal government, the United States Department of Agriculture. They have the support of universities, such as the University of Minnesota. They have a lot of power and a lot of money, and you know, we'll do anything to increase their profits. Again, including turning animals into sort of foreign creatures that are going to suffer. And what we're saying is, that instead of meddling with the building blocks of life, we need to focus on improving existing living conditions, halt pollution that's pouring into our oceans, clean up the saturated fat and cholesterol-laden diet that leads to cancer, heart disease, and stroke, and grow food locally so tomatoes don't need animal genes to prolong shelf life to absurd unnatural time spans. There's answers out there, but it's not in genetic engineering.
Olivia Kramer, what was the reaction of the residents of Minneapolis and the local press to the protests and to the idea that Seattle-type confrontations had come to their city?
Well, obviously the press sensationalized the entire thing and actually they've really served the police in a lot of ways by repeating misinformation that the police have been putting out. And actually, one story went international about supposed the finding of cyanide canisters, which is a completely bunk story, I'd like to say, and there's absolutely no substantiation.
Right. We read about this in the news, that at a local McDonald's they found cyanide canisters and that the police were attributing them to the protesters.
What it seems like happened was stink bombs, and they have attempted to say that it was cyanide canisters that harmed people, and yet the only injuries, supposedly, that happened was some people who were overcome by the fumes. And also, apparently, the canisters were actually found to contain lower levels of cyanide than apple seeds, and that the existence of cyanide in this fluid was just totally exacerbated. And, in fact, we're hearing rumors now that it was actually rotten tamari. And, you know, cyanide is a naturally occurring chemical, and actually some public health official here in Minneapolis yesterday announced that the liquid that was found is deemed to not have posed a public health threat, but if it had been in larger quantities, it may have. That's what the quote was.
So we're talking about the American Kennel Club, the Canine Health Foundation, the Ralston Purina Company, Hybrid Turkeys, PE, Celera, Aggen, Pig Improvement Company, University of Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station. We are going to be joined. We were hoping to be joined by the organizer of this conference, but he won't be able to join us right now. It's called the International Conference on Animal Genetics. If people want to get in touch, Peter Wood with PETA, where do they call or go on the web?
They can go to our website at www.petaonline.org, or they can call 757-622-7382.
And Olivia Kramer, the person whose house got raided, what happened?
Well, essentially, it's a house that was known to be where a lot of the organizing was coming out of. And Monday night, we were all sitting here talking about the protests and writing things up about it. And all of a sudden, about 10 police officers stormed into the house with shields, pushed everyone on the ground, were calling us names, essentially, being very verbally violent and physically violent. They kicked one of the residents of the house in the head, like full on in the face, when he was on the floor, and proceeded to search the house. There was the FBI was present, the DEA, and a Minneapolis gang strike task force was present. And they had come under the auspices of, with a search warrant for drug trafficking, which they found absolutely no substantiation of. They left with a minor possession charge for somebody, and they got all of our phone books. They took our computer. They were sitting here on the computer for an hour going through all of our email. I mean, they tried to question us. Obviously, nobody would talk to them. They arrested everyone in the house for disorderly house, and then kept a couple people on suspicion of narcotics trafficking, which they dropped. And, you know, they've basically, in my opinion, they were trying to retaliate against us for what happened in the streets on Monday, which was essentially people standing up for themselves and people really refusing to back down to the police and taking our rights to march seriously. And so I think that after all this buildup, I mean, they spent $1 million mobilizing for this conference. There was 200 people, 200 protesters. And, you know, they really thought there was going to be it was going to be like Seattle.
Well, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves. We have been just told that the organizer of the conference is joining us. So we're going to continue this segment for a minute after the break, and then we'll go to the two reporters, one of the only reporters in the country, two of the only reporters in the country, suing their news organization for saying that they were interfering with the content of their news story. We'll be talking with Jane Acree and Steve Wilson, who tried to do a series on Monsanto for Fox in Florida. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
I'm Mark Cooper, inviting you to join me all next week when I'll be broadcasting live from the site of the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia. We'll be covering the goings-on inside the convention center, the protests in the street, and the alternative shadow convention. Join me, Mark Cooper, all next week, live from Philadelphia at 4 p.m. right here on KPFK Los Angeles.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. And in addition to the activists Olivia Kramer and Peter Wood, who've been involved with the protests against the major international conference on animal genetics that has taken place this week in Minneapolis, we've been joined by Larry Shook, who's the director of the Food Animal Biotechnology Center at the University of Minnesota.
Well, welcome to Democracy Now!, Mr. Shook. Could you tell us what the purpose of the conference was, and if you've been hearing some of what the opponents have been saying, what your reaction to their opposition is?
Let me start by saying I appreciate having a chance to join the program. I just joined. I haven't had a chance to hear the previous comments, but this is the 27th meeting of the Congress. It's every 2 years, and it's held to with two points: one, to exchange information and ideas, and to bring scientists from all over the world together, from poor and rich countries, to share in advances in technology.
And what about the protesters outside? Do you see any legitimate concern in some of the issues that they were raising about the concern that many have about where genetic engineering is going?
Well, I think the points that were brought out are points for discussion. And clearly, you know, this society, I should add, it is represented by 51 different countries. We had members from 48 countries that were at the Congress. As you can appreciate, each of these people come from countries that have very diverse and different regulations. And so there, even within the society, there's active discussions about you know, issues and impact of policy on science.
Can you tell us, for the ISAG scientists, that's the International Conference on Animal Genetics, what their goals are in mapping the genomes of common livestock and animals, determining what are they trying to determine?
Well, if I could just maybe expand that a little bit. The society has three areas, I would say, that it focuses on. One is looking at genetic diseases in companion animals. These would include horses and dogs. So the research is focused at how we can eliminate genetic diseases in our companion animals. Another area, in fact, we had a workshop that was funded by the United Nations Food Agriculture Organization. It was to look at how we can use genetic analyses to look and determine populations of local breeds of animals that may be at risk. So how we can use new genetic tools to solve biodiversity issues. And the third area is how we can use genetic information to increase food production. I should add that of the 650 participants, only two of the presentations had to do with genetic engineering.
Olivia Kramer, do you have one question for Larry Shook? Olivia Kramer with the Minneapolis group Grain Rage, Resistance Against Genetic Engineering.
Well, I guess the one thing that I would ask is I don't understand why scientists feel that they are operating in a bubble, that they should be unaccountable to public inquiry, and that it seems like the only defense that they use is that we're doing the research, it's up to public policy to determine how it's used. And yet, if the research weren't being done and these advances, so-called advances, weren't being made, maybe people's resources and time would be better spent on preventing diseases, preventing agricultural disasters that have caused these crises in biodiversity that now you're trying to say that that genetic research is going to solve. I mean, don't you believe in conservation biology and in ecological sciences?
Well, I do. And actually, as I said, a third of our program dealt with biodiversity and defined biodiversity. I should say that majority of the people that were here are receiving funding from your governments. We had a number of scientists who come from countries, China and Japan, where they're actually, you know, the public directly funds their research. So to say that it's in a bubble, I think, is not accurate. In fact,
well, those same governments are responsible for all sorts of, structural adjustment programs and poverty and agricultural waste. I mean, I don't think that just because they're coming from government funding that it's somehow benign.
Well, I would agree with that. But I think the point that you were making earlier and one I was going to follow up on was the idea that it's being done in a bubble and that there isn't public discussion.
There isn't.
And here in the United States, clearly there's been a number of issues of debating public investment into biotechnology, and they will continue.
What about the development of the science itself? I mean, the scientists keep saying that we have no right to oppose this science when we don't know anything about the technicalities behind it, and yet there's all these ecological and health risks, there's ethical questions, there's the question of corporate control over life itself, the commodification of life on a genetic level. I mean, these are really important questions that the scientists seem absolutely unwilling to even think about.
Well, I wouldn't agree with that point. In fact, the human genome effort, one of the fundamental tenets of that is to include an ethical and social and legal issue. And here at the University of Minnesota, we clearly have, a very active bioethics center, and our Center for Biomedical Genomics has a very, very active program now in education and in ethics. So I don't think that's a fair assessment that scientists are not, and the research agendas are not, looking at those social and ethical and legal issues.
Well, what do you think about the ethics behind humans controlling and manipulating animals on a genetic level and turning them into machines for profit-making?
Well,
because that's one of...
If a farmer raising crops or raising cattle or egg-laying chickens is for corporate profit, Then I guess I'm for it.
Well, a lot of it is, a lot of it isn't, and a lot of it is. What you're doing, what the International Society for Animal Genetics is doing, is advancing agribusiness, is creating new tools for agribusiness to use as weapons against poor people and the environment.
Couldn't disagree with you more, because we had, in fact, the majority of the people that were here, and I think you may have argument, but you picked the wrong group to present that
right,
again.
Right, because you don't have any.
The International Society clearly is a very diverse group that comes from rich, poor, and countries. In fact, the Society provided funding for 30 scientists to come from some of the poorest countries, so they would have access to the information, so that to your point of corporate exploitation, it couldn't be further from the truth with this group of at the Society.
Well, just because scientists come from poor countries doesn't mean that they're representing the needs of poor people, peasant farmers, and people who are suffering under structural adjustment and capitalism.
But it also means that they are having access to information, and I think that you're transforming issues that may have occurred because of corporate patenting with the Society, that really is a grassroots group, and in some of the arguments that you're presenting are well-founded and I think are really issues that should be addressed. And I think they're in a, the issues that you're raising are very consistent with some of the questions that are raised by the society.
Well, on this note, we do have to wrap up the discussion, but I want to say that these discussions should be happening at a national and international level where activists, scientists, academics, policymakers get together and we all make decisions about the future of life on Earth.
And clearly, most people around the rest of the country would not have even been involved in this debate had the protesters not been outside in Minneapolis and made this conference a news issue.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Olivia Kramer, member of the local Minneapolis group Grain Rage, Resistance Against Genetic Engineering, who was outside. Close to 100 people got arrested. As inside the International Society of Animal Scientists was taking place, Larry Shook with us as well, director of the Food Animal Biotechnology Center at the University of Minnesota. But we're going to stay on the issue of biotechnology because we're going to turn now to fired Fox News reporters Steve Wilson and Jane Acree. In 1997, Jane Acree and Steve Wilson were working on a story for Fox-owned TV station WTVT, Fox 13, in Tampa, Florida, where they were hired to do hard-hitting investigative reports. They discovered milk in Florida and throughout the U.S. was being affected by bovine growth hormone, RBGH. The Fox station was promoting the story aggressively that they were going to be doing until the night before it was scheduled to air, when the Monsanto Corporation threatened Fox. Fox then demanded that Acree and Wilson change their story. They put them through 83 rewrites and eventually fired them just before Christmas of 97. Well, last week, these two veteran investigative journalists took Fox to court and say they're ready to prove how Fox TV managers and lawyers ordered them to deliberately distort news reports, then fired them for resisting those directives. Steve Wilson and Jane Acree join us now from their home in Florida. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Hello.
Well, tell us how this case is going.
You know, before we start, I must say, listening to the last interview, with absolutely no disrespect intended, I love to hear these biotech industry folks talk about how they welcome public discussion. That certainly was not our experience. What happened, as you said, was we were pressured by Fox after Fox was in turn originally pressured by Monsanto to either not tell the story or to tell it in a way that was just flatly wrong. They wanted us to broadcast information that we knew to be false and misleading, and that led to a year-long fight and eventually our termination, and we've spent the last 2 weeks now in court trying to convince a jury that we are whistleblowers under the Florida law that protects people who refuse to do things that are illegal. We say it's illegal to go on radio or television and broadcast deliberately distorted news reports. And interestingly enough, this company, which calls itself News Corporation, is now arguing that, you know, technically, they say to the judge, there is no law, rule, or regulation to prevent broadcasters from deliberately distorting the news. It's just a policy of the government.
Well, Steve, we've reported on Democracy Now! Numerous times about the efforts of Monsanto around the world to quash any kind of public discussion of some of the activities it's involved in. But I know as a fellow journalist, it must have been a big step on yours and Jane's part to actually go to court and risk being branded throughout the profession and the industry for taking your employers to court. Can you talk a little bit, Jane, perhaps, about how you decided to take this step?
Well, you know, one of the things Steve didn't mention is that they had offered us a rather attractive buyout if we would just either, A, do what the lawyers said in putting this story on the air, or, B, just shut up about it because there was a confidentiality clause in our contract that would prevent us from talking about anything we learned while we were employed by the station. And it took Steve and I about, 5 seconds to say, no, this is a public health issue. This needs to be discussed. If this was about some minor two-bit player on some minor story, I think we would have probably parted ways. But, no, this was a public health issue, and that is essentially what made us continue with this story as opposed to walk away. It is a public health issue. It deserves to be discussed. And so we stuck with it, and we kept trying to get the story on the air for months and months and months. And ultimately, we were unsuccessful, and they fired us.
And you are quite right. I mean, we've been told by friends at various levels that will never work in mainstream journalism again. Those days are over for having the audacity to stand up and take your employer to court. People, as you know, recent studies have shown, people in newsrooms just keep their mouths shut. You apparently have to check your ethics at the door these days and keep your head down if you want to keep your job.
Ralph Nader, Walter Cronkite, they're on your witness list for the trial?
Ralph Nader's already been to town. He's been in the courtroom. There was a huge fight. The Fox attorneys, who I might mention, are the same attorneys who, from the law firm that represents President Clinton. Fox has now hired, after losing efforts to derail the case, about a year or so ago, they hired attorneys from Williams and Connolly, and they argued ferociously to keep Nader out. The judge allowed him in as an expert witness, and we wanted him there, and he did a wonderful job, I thought, of explaining to the jury how television businesses are different than any other businesses, that because they operate using a license and the public airwaves, which is a very scarce public resource, they have a duty, a legal obligation to operate in the public interest, and that makes them somewhat different, and that's what they didn't do, we argue, in this case.
And why Walter Cronkite?
Walter Cronkite was called to talk about the pre-broadcast review process. Who gets to make the final choice on news stories? The lawyers are hired by the broadcasting companies to protect the broadcasting companies, and there's been evidence in this case that the president of Fox Television instructed the lawyers, take no risks. And what happens when you have lawyers who want to do investigative, you know, riskless investigative reporting, which is an oxymoron that can't be, ever happen, and journalists who have testified that they wanted to tell the truth? Who gets to decide? And Mr. Cronkite's testimony deals with the fact that in good news organizations, those decisions are made by journalists when they gather the truth and can document that it's true.
And you have to love the irony here, because here's Fox arguing that Mr. Cronkite is not an expert in the pre-broadcast review process, and they're going to try to get him his testimony thrown out of court. You know, there are comic moments here.
When Fox, of course, didn't even exist when Cronkite started in the business.
You know, home of When Animals Attack and Who Wants to Marry a Multimillionaire. Of course, that's not their news programming, but that's kind of where they're coming from.
Their news programming is which local pizza parlor puts the most cheese on your pizza. That's their news programming locally.
I guess the question is there bovine growth hormone in that cheese? Now, last question. That is, I remember when we had you on in debate with Fox a while ago when this first happened, and one of the edits you went through, they told you to take out that Monsanto, which is the maker of bovine growth hormone, had also been involved with the making of, was it Agent Orange? Dioxin.
Actually, that part was left in, but what we had uncovered was that there was a EPA investigation into the way Monsanto brought PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, into the marketplace. And the EPA had concluded that Monsanto was fraudulent in the way it did that. And that came out.
Well, more than fraudulent, that they were guilty of a pattern of deliberately distorting the science that led to the approval of PCBs in the first place. And there are those who say that's exactly what they've tried to do with bovine growth hormone. Well, the lawyers didn't want any parallels, even any mention of the fact that these folks have been found guilty of a similar pattern in the past.
That would be defamation by implication.
Hmm. Well, what do you hope to get out of this? We have about 10 seconds out of this trial.
I hope it to be over. Win, lose, or draw, I think we've made our point, and you know, I would hope that people will stand up for reporters who refuse to lie on television, because once reporters start buckling under to corporate pressure to tell what corporations want known as opposed to the truth, it's all over for decent journalism.
You have a website?
We do. It's www.foxbgh, like bovine growth hormone, foxbghsuit.com.
That's www.foxbghsuit.com. I want to thank you very much for being with us. We're going to get back in touch with you as this trial continues, the lawsuit Steve Wilson and Jane Akrey have brought against Fox. We are at the end of this program. Democracy Now! Produced by Jeremy Scahill, Anthony Sloan, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director. Thanks to Neil Geiser and Deepa Fernandez. We'll be in Philadelphia for all of next week covering the Republican National Convention. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Broadcasting out of WBAI in New York.